are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
Welcome to Serious Growth Podcast, where the truth is told. On today's show, we have Frank Shamrock. Frank, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Man, hey, you know, I was reading your bio, and I don't know if I should, yeah, it's very diverse and impressive all at the same time, but I don't, you know, should I be afraid of you? I mean, I'm glad that at this point we're friendly still, right? But I'm reading this stuff. I'm thinking, wait a minute, maybe I should be worried that I'm going to get my ass kicked or something. I don't know.
Yeah, well, thankfully I can't get through the computer, so you're probably
That's safe. What I was thinking. I was thinking I was pretty safe, unless you had some magical powers or something. So, okay, yeah. I'm going to get right to it, man. I mean, you are many things, that's for sure. Visionary, entrepreneur. I'm more interested in talking to you about ex-con, to be quite honest with you, since you put it up there. Let's talk about that and go from there. How about that?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I left home when I was just 12 years old, and okay. I became a ward of the state of California.
Oh.
And I got out of my home, which was an abusive home, by committing crime. And so I thought that was, I thought I was a genius. And I had found the solution to avoiding these types of situations. So I actually leaned into crime, became a full-time criminal.
No kidding.
By the time I was 18, I was sent to prison for 3.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I spent from 18 to about 22 in prison. And then I got out and started a career in mixed martial arts.
You know, we all have a story. You know, life is just it just presents a pathway. And it's interesting how some people like yourself end up finding that pathway that makes it a positive situation. And yet so many people just go completely the other way, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm going to assume then, you know, cause like for me, bodybuilding was something that saved my life at some point, you know, it was just something that I needed and I had an athletic background. So the mixed martial arts, what took you down that path after you had served some, I would say that's hard time, man. So what put you on that path?
Yeah, well, I definitely did some hard time. I went to the all the major prisons in California. And, you know, it was really just one man. When I was 12, I ended up in the Shamrock Boys Ranch, which was a pretty hardcore work ranch for kids right about to go to youth prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Bob Shamrock. He's my first real father figure.
Okay.
And he's just a wonderful man who, you know, would teach us about athletics, and he was a huge bodybuilding fan.
Okay.
And so was I. And he really, you know, taught that, you know, through community and through family and through building up your body and your mind and your spirit, that you could be successful, you know, as an athlete or as an entertainer.
Yeah.
And I always had this dream of becoming a boxing champion. Was one of the first things I ever saw on television when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And so I had this dream, and it just happened to be that there was an emerging sport when I got out of prison, and that was the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championship.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the worlds converged. I spent my time in prison lifting weights, building my body.
Yeah.
You know, Bob was sort of my, he still was my mentor and my, you know, overall cheerleader.
Yeah.
But his advice was build your body, build your mind, you know, you screwed your life up, but there's another chance coming in a few years. And it just happened to be that this sport was emerging as I was emerging from, you know, Folsom Prison, God's sakes. And I just grasped onto it. You know, I became a student of the arts and of fighting and of life. And it was all uphill from there.
Well, you know, the thing about that is we all have these, you know, as an athlete coming up, I had my mentors too. It sounded like you got a mentor there that really steered you in the right direction. But, and listen, when you get into a sport like mixed martial arts, I mean, I think that and again, doesn't that take a certain mentality? I mean, you know, most people get into it more of a lot of people like myself would get into a more like football, basketball, baseball. You're getting into a sport that is violent, basically, I think, even though it's teaching you it's a discipline, but what does it take a certain personality to get into that sport to begin with?
I don't know. I think it just takes an athletic desire. I was not a person who was into violence. And in fact, I was, you know, because I grew up in a home of physical abuse. So
yeah.
It was actually quite challenging for me to hurt people. took a large learning curve for me to be in a position where I was okay with, you know, beating people up.
Yeah, that's what I would think. You know, I'm misinformed, you know, because.
Yeah. I mean, the average person, I think, you know, it takes a hurdle for them to get from point A to point B.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had a psychological barrier. You know, I was in a sport where, you know, our job was to beat each other up, but I still didn't want to hurt people.
Interesting.
And so that took a long time for me to overcome. And I was able to overcome that through, you know, sheer athleticism. I was a better athlete than everybody.
Yeah.
So I would make them tired. I would, you know, try to beat them up without hurting them.
Interesting.
And then once I realized that was kind of crazy, that I really needed to just, you know, apply the techniques that I'd learned, then it became a psychological development where I had to sort of accept these facts. You know, I call it swinging the sword. You're going to pick up the sword. You better swing it. Otherwise you're going to get chopped down. And so once I made that, you know, transition, but I think in general, one of the people's biggest fears is a physical, you know, altercation.
Oh yeah.
But the reality is the reason why they're afraid is because they don't know what to do.
Interesting.
So once you know what to do, then it's no longer fearful because you're trained at it. So it's like being in the military. You know what your role is.
Yeah.
You have the skills to do it. And then it no longer sort of holds that power over you.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, it's like having that, you become, you know, proactive because you understand a few things and it does change the dynamic. I remember the first time I got in a fight, Frank, a real fight, because I never had to, as an athlete, when I was coming up, no one messed with me. I never went looking for a fight to begin with, but no one messed with me, you know? And and at some point I was curious. So I'm down in LA, and working down there, and I decided that I wanted to test myself. So I went and got a job as a bouncer.
Nice.
You know, I thought I'm gonna get in a fight as a bouncer. I mean, it just seems like, you know, it's bound to happen, you know. And so I did that, and I tell you what, the first time I got in a fight, oh my God, I mean, I was shaking, the adrenaline was flowing. You know, I didn't like it, but I tell you what, I did learn about myself is I can handle myself, and I had no skill. I never had a fight. Like you know, you learn a skill and you actually got confidence, I'm assuming, from knowing how to do your skill. And I had none of that. And I tell you, I was scared to death, but that fear actually worked for me because I never lost, Frank. I never lost a fight, you know? So there was something about that motivation, but I guess what you did is just took it to a completely, it's just like bodybuilding. You know, when you get to the point where you, you've trained so much, you almost become a master and really in control of your you know, the sport that you're in. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree totally. And it really is about the personal experience.
Yeah.
You know, all the guys that I met that were tough guys, they were tough guys because they went and got in street fights. And so they weren't as afraid as the rest of us. And they were able to make, you know, sort of decisions, you know, in those high stress moments that everyone else sort of, you know, gets clouded or crumbles or, you know, doesn't participate in.
Yeah.
And that was my total experience with fighting. You know, I went from this kind of scared kid. And I mean, I was like the punching bag in the beginning because I didn't know anything.
Yeah.
But I was big and strong and athletic. So I was a great workout tool.
Yeah.
You know, for the guy who knew stuff. Yeah. I was a wonderful punching bag.
Yeah. You were good for the guy that was trying some new techniques, right?
Yeah. I was that guy. And then, you know, I didn't know that it was a culture where you weren't really supposed to ask questions back then.
Yeah.
You know, traditional martial arts, you don't ask questions, you just do. It's like the military.
Yeah.
And so I was the guy, because I didn't know, so I'd ask a question and then I would receive a beating as an answer.
Yeah.
But I was able to find the solutions and the answers inside of the beating.
That is so funny. That's ironic in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
That's how a lot of people learn, the hard way.
Yeah.
You figure it out. You bang your head enough times and then you sort of figure it out.
You know, I had I watched a documentary of, I think it was the Eagles, the band, and they were talking to lead singer, and he said something. He says, you know, when you're starting out like this, he goes, you got to suck a lot before you get better. And it's almost kind of what you're saying. You have to just, it's that process that you have to go through. And that in itself, I think for some people, maybe even most, that's kind of a deal breaker. Some just say, I can't do this. And yet there was some motivation there for you that was greater than the obstacle, obviously, you know, that made you just say, oh no, I'm going to hang in here and learn this thing. You know, I'm not going to walk away from this. That's pretty interesting. And I would just think that, I think I may have talked to somebody else that was a UFC fighter, and it was like, when you start getting to the point where you're at, does it change the speed of the game actually start changing when you're actually in the ring? In other words, does the game slow down to where you can actually think in there, or is it just strictly just muscle memory and your training and just reacting?
It eventually slows down.
Yeah.
But it's like being in a gunfight. You know, it's an old saying, if you get in a fist fight, you hit with a fist. If you get a knife fight, you hit with a knife. If you get in a gun fight, you hit with a gun.
Yeah.
It's very similar to that, but through training and through, you know, self-awareness and through practice, like you can slowly start to master those things.
Yeah.
And that to me was the beauty. Like I could feel after a certain term that I could think, and I could think creatively, and I could filter what was coming into my brain. But I mean, that took years and years.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, your lifeline is whatever your corner tells you, because it goes in one ear and then your body sort of reacts to it. So you're very dependent on this sort of third person coach, view, mentor.
Yeah.
And you know, as long as that connection and that trust is there, you know, you're sort of this, it's like a video game. You're sort of this fighting machine, because there's so little time to comprehend what's going on. There's so much stress. Yeah. And then in truth, for a long time, I couldn't even tell what was going on, because my perception of it was vastly different than the reality of what was happening.
Right.
I couldn't see if he was tired. I couldn't see if he was hurt.
Right.
I couldn't see that there was, you know, repetitiveness in his system.
Right.
Because I was just trying to deal with the stressors of the moment.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I relate that to like, well, not only just being an athlete and just, you know, when you first step up, like when I went from high school to college, the game automatically got faster. Like guys are older, you know, but then as the game slowed down, it was just like the whole different dynamic, you know, and in bodybuilding, same way. The first show that I ever did, Frank, because we had to do a posing routine for like 90 seconds.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you do all these reps beforehand and I was just posing. And right before I get to go out on stage, well, I forgot my whole routine. I thought, oh, shit. You know, and so just because I did all these reps, that carried me through on stage. I don't remember the first time I did my posing routine. I don't remember what happened. I just thought, oh my God, I got through it. People were coming and telling me, oh my God, you did such a good job. And I didn't remember one thing, but there was nothing better than after years after doing bodybuilding. And when the game slowed down, that's when it got really fun for me, because I was actually seeing the crowd and I was, you know, even though it was still a fast game in so many ways, but just that whole, it's amazing how time changes like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and to me, it's all stimuli, because, you know, when you're sort of in control of your environment and you have the repetitions and you have the practice, like anything, business, speaking, fighting, bodybuilding, everything's the same.
Yeah,
I mean, I work with a lot of actors as like a mentor and a coach, and I manage assets, and they tell me the exact same thing. They're like, I went out, I forgot all my lines the minute I hit the stage, and then I just started reacting to what my training was and to what my partner was saying, and then it just kind of came out.
Yeah.
But it's that to me is the great art form.
Yeah.
You can take something so, what people view as so challenging or so, you know, hard, like fighting, and make it look, you know, like graceful and artistic, and then have those personal expressions in the middle of it. That to me is the real art.
Yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing is unbelievably, after this bodybuilding thing for me was over, I was kind of left like I needed something like to motivate me. You know, I didn't realize how much motivation the stage was. So when I was like retired, if you will, I was like, I kind of like the idea of being in shape more than actually being in shape. So long story short, I got into fashion, believe it or not. I was a guy as a bodybuilder. I looked homeless because I didn't care what I just threw stuff over me. You know, I just cared what I looked like on stage. So to me, to get into the fashion industry, I wrote a book about it. It's called From Homeless to Handsome and Then Some. And the thing that's really interesting in what you're talking about, making something hard look easy, in an Italian term, is called sprezzatura, and it's studied carelessness. It's making the hard look easy. In other words, the way you dress, not forced. It's just something that just happens. It's elegant. It's easy, and yet it's something that's very hard. But through all those reps, and that's the stuff that you go through, that's what you've created, that sprezzatura in your sport. You've made it elegant and you've made it look easy, right?
Yeah, that was my biggest, you know, my first study was to not get hurt.
Yeah.
That was like the first study, right? Because you're in this immediate feedback zone where if it doesn't work, you get clobbered.
Right.
And so then you got to sort of figure that out. But then the second one was to try to create the first perfect system.
Yeah.
Where I could defeat anybody.
Yeah.
And then once that had been done, then I was like, well, you know, is my job done? But it wasn't, because I realized it was just starting, because then I could figure out my artistic expression, like what I wanted to do with all this stuff.
Yeah.
And that to me was the best part. Like the last 5 years of my career, when I did the Strike Force League, it was just the best, because I was, each time I was in there, you know, I wasn't scared. You know, I was full. I had the system that I could rely on.
Yeah.
And I could perform. And like really perform. Like I would do crazy things, like telling people and put them to sleep. And you know, like I could feel the response of the crowd to my art form. And that was the best years of my life. I was getting older and I was like, my back was hurting.
Yeah.
But still that feedback of the performance was like the best part for me.
Well, and you were able to take it in. You were able to absorb that and
enjoy it.
I know. Like when I retired and came back at an older age, it had a whole different perspective to me. It's like I got another chance to compete again. I was 50 at this point, 54, 55. I just was curious if muscle really did have memory. That's the reason why I did it, you know.
Yeah.
Plus I still love the sport. But boy, I tell you what, it was such what a great feeling it was. And that for me too was probably my favorite time was actually later on, you know, when I could really absorb that and really enjoyed that. How many years does it take for somebody to get to your level as a mixed martial artist? How many years of training and what does that look like?
A lot of people ask me this question. And so for me, I think it was harder because I had to actively seek the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, while training, while trying to get through all that stuff, while trying to figure out how to fight, I also had to try to figure out how to create a system because there were no systems. No, it was a new sport. No one really knew what to do. So the hardest part for me in the beginning, besides not being fearful, was figuring out an art form that I could rely on and then finding the mechanics and finding that system. And I'd have to go from individual to individual to get it because it was mixed martial arts and no one had mixed them all together.
Yeah.
So I think for me, the first 5 years was me just trying to figure it out and sort through all the information.
Yeah.
To answer your question, I think it takes about five, six years.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have a really good system and you know your body, that's why, you know, for me, bodybuilding was essential because I studied the biomechanics of the human body.
Yeah.
So when people would teach me stuff, I'd be like, yeah, but how does that work with the biomechanics of the human body?
Yeah.
And no one had ever asked those questions before.
Yeah.
So it was easy to filter through some of the nonsense. So I think it takes about 5-6 years of really focused study. It's almost like college.
Yeah.
And by the time you end college, you're like, wow, I kind of know stuff.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing in this sport. Most people hit their peak about 7 or 8. So they kind of get it together, they focus on it, and then, you know, they have 5-6 years of fruit.
Yeah.
And they're old, like me.
Yeah. Well, it takes a while, man. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. I know even with in bodybuilding, that the first few years it was learning, you know, Don Ross was a mentor of mine. He used to write for a magazine. And he said something one time when we were at Goals. He said, and he was referring to the actual exercise and training. He said, everything works to a degree. It's to what degree that it works for you. And what he was saying basically was that you got to try a lot of stuff. And in bodybuilding, it's finding those that staple, that core group of exercises that always work for you. You know, and how can you find that out unless you actually go through that process, you know? And I think, well, you are telling me, I think there's no better way to learn it than to do it firsthand, to learn it yourself, because that's the, you know, Albert Einstein said, you know, real knowledge is through experience, firsthand experience. And that's what you and I both have, it sounds like, you know, to go through that process. And then it sounds like to me, then you, when you get to that point, it's kind of like a foundation. And then you start making things your own. I'm assuming you experimented with a few things and you would either put it into your arsenal or just kick it out and say, no, that doesn't work. That doesn't work for my style or something like that, I'm guessing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, in the early days, it was very much, you know, figured out as you go because nobody really knew.
Yeah.
And I was blessed enough to have the first complete system that everything, you know, connected and made sense biomechanically and it was sustainable and, but yeah, I mean, and you know, growing up on the streets and, you know, going to prison and having all this experience, I could tell when someone was selling me, you know, snake oil and when someone really didn't know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one or two questions in, there was no answer. Then I'd be right. So it was easy for me to take information and speaking of application, to try it immediately.
Yeah.
To have the result. And so I think in a lot of different, you know, sports, fighting is probably the most intimate one. Because you know day one, you're like,
yeah.
So you get immediate feedback. Like it's really quick on the learning curve.
That's really a good point, isn't it?
Yeah. Right away.
Right away, you know if it's working or not. That's pretty funny. Oh my goodness. Anyway, okay, so let's tell me how you because my and part of my background is I'm a sports specific or strength and conditioning specialist. All that means is that I train athletes. Okay, just it sounds like you. I've trained at the highest level, you know, Major League Baseball, football, all those guys. Now, what's really important at that level, especially, and this also ties into your mixed martial art, is that you make sure that you are on a program that enhances what you do inside the ring. Because if you don't train correctly, obviously you're not going to get the right result. So how did you, you know, I know you're talking that you're into bodybuilding, but were you into bodybuilding in its truest sense as far as how it applies to a bodybuilder? Or did you create a routine that was based on your sport?
I modified bodybuilding.
Okay.
So what happened in my world was I was far too small to be fighting in an open weight class, you know, anything goes fighting sport. So some of my guys were 250, you know, 220 pounds and, you know, a foot taller than me. So, you know, what I applied through bodybuilding was the ability to gain weight and to hold muscle mass. Because I knew that mass would equal energy and that once moving would create damage and create movement, you know, create more movement.
Right.
So for me, it was always trying to get bigger.
Yeah.
So I wasn't, you know, at the time, I mean, we were just learning about vascular training. We were just learning about like interval training and stuff like that. All that was slowly trickling into the sport.
Yeah.
But for me, it was always about how much mass could I hold on my body? I'm 5'10". I weigh naturally 181 pounds.
Uh-huh.
I was fighting guys that were 250.
How is it that they put you in a class like that? I would think like in bodybuilding, you're in a class that is makes it kind of equal that way. I think.
Yeah.
That's
where the sport started.
Yeah. So
that's where it started. One class, one set of rules, which was no rules, and then it was one time, and so you just kind of went for it. It was very much like freestyle fighting. You know, anything goes.
Wow.
I was the first ever middleweight champion.
Okay.
So when we started getting political pressure, when we started getting kicked off of cable networks,
you
know, the solution was to create weight classes.
Ah, there you go.
Try to make it more sporting-like.
Gotcha.
I was the first ever middleweight weight class champion, which at the time was 199.99 and below.
Okay.
But that still put me at about, you know, 20 pounds less than everybody else.
Right.
Who was in the middleweight class, because everybody else was 215 and they were cutting down to 199 or 225 cutting down.
Yeah.
So I was always just small. And so my routine was I ate every night before I went to bed. You know, I lifted weights 6 days a week. I was very much on this maintain mass and size so that I could perform against these bigger, you know, stronger people.
Yeah. Is it more advantageous for you to be at the top of your weight class as opposed to the bottom of your weight class, or does it matter? Yeah.
Totally, because this is just, you know, because of the sort of wrestling element and, you know, it's short, intense performance element.
Right.
A lot of people are dropping, you know, 10, 15 pounds.
Okay. It's kind of like wrestling.
Yeah. So I fought Tito Ortiz. He walks around at 225, 230 pounds.
Yeah.
But he was able to make 199.9.
Yeah.
And my natural body weight, like at the time, I was 191. That was with all the muscle I could stack on me.
Yeah.
In performing. So the weight difference, you know, is 30, 35, 40 pounds.
Yeah,
that's massive.
That's
40 pounds behind a punch extra.
Yeah.
Just does tremendous, you know, damage to your brain because it can't withstand that type of contact.
Yeah, exactly. So how many days a week were you training and how many days a week did you train for mixed martial arts? Like daily? 6 days a week, every day?
6 days a week. The only day I took off was Sunday.
Okay.
I'd go to church and I'd spend time with my family. But
literally,
I would train off season at least once a day, 6 days a week.
Okay.
And it was either my bodybuilding, you know, weight retention type workout.
Yeah.
or it was a technical workout where I was studying fighting, it was, you know, teaching, studying, practicing the techniques. And then anytime we were pre-camp, it went to 2 a days. And then anytime we were in camp, it was 3 a days. And a lot of times that third one was just massage, chiropractic,
recovery, you
know, basically medical care
for
what I was doing to my body
so
that I could perform again and study again the next day.
Okay. So you're doing that, let's just say 6 days a week for now. And then you're training bodybuilding. You're doing how many days a week? Six?
Six, too. But those would be one of those three workouts.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So here, let me ask you this now. Is mixed martial arts a strength sport or an explosive type sport?
It's an explosive technical sport.
Okay.
Yeah. Strength is valuable, but it's all about the technique.
Okay, so then if you had to pick the two, you want to go for explosive, being explosive inside the ring.
Yes, totally, yeah.
Okay.
And if we had weight classes back then, I wouldn't need to run a bodybuilding weight, you know, retention type program. I would have just fought at my natural weight, which is at the time would have been in the 185 weight class.
Yeah. Okay. So let me just talk to you from my background now. Okay. So, because here's what was going on when I was coming through, the colleges at the higher level had some strength coaches, but at the high school level, they really didn't. But here's what we learned about training for strength and power. Okay. Cause those are very different. Power means explosive power. And of course, strength is just being strong. Now, what was going on back then, a lot of the coaches were training their athletes, especially at the high school level. Five sets of five was the big deal back then.
Okay,
that's a pure strength training regimen, okay? But here's the problem with that. When you train somebody for pure strength like that, and I'm going to get to my question as it relates to you. When you train for strength like that, and even though we're talking about football now, football is a combination of strength and explosiveness, okay, depending on the position that you play. But if you only train for strength, Frank, it makes you stronger, but it makes you slower on the field. So my question is, when you're training for bodybuilding, that's not being really – I don't know your exact routine, by the way. I'm just going by – I know what a bodybuilding routine looks like. So if you're training just as a bodybuilder, then you're not really training for explosive power. Are you?
Or not particularly.
You're not.
Yeah, you're not.
I mean, yeah, you're not. So my question then would be, I wonder how much better you would have been if you actually trained, if your routine now, because you know you learn more as you go along, if your routine that you were doing was a combination of training for strength, because you need that, and also training for explosive power. I mean, look, you're a four-time world champion. I don't know how much better you can get, but I just wonder how much quicker or how much more explosive, how much better that you would have been inside the ring?
Yeah, it's unknown because by the time I got to the last 5 years of my career, I was so banged up, I could barely do explosive, like hardcore explosive stuff.
Yeah.
But where I was able to benefit was I was strong, you know, I was big, I had great vascular training.
Yeah.
And then this is what's unique about our sport. There's a million explosive moments.
Yeah.
And each one of those reverse a position, change a position, damage your opponent, you know, create an opening. And so I would focus all of my, like one of those workouts was purely technical breathing, explosive movements with my entire body.
Okay.
And so it wasn't.
This is actually you now training martial arts.
Yeah. Martial arts. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, like, because each fight is different.
Yeah.
Because each opponent has a different mechanics and body and system and everything else. So where I found my magic formula was, you know, if I was fighting a wrestler, it was all about explosive mat drills off my back and how to get on top and damage on in the process and then control that position and go for submission. So, you know, I would spend months just on my back doing breathing explosive, like quick, you know, and then combinations of movements that would change the position big enough for me to get into a more advantageous position.
Yeah, and what it sounds like to me then is your actual training for mixed martial arts and the stuff that you were doing was actually acting as that, like the person that would be weight training. Your explosiveness was all done. You did it with your actual martial arts that you were doing, and that offset. I think that makes it a nice blend that your bodybuilding was actually acting like the strength side of it, if you will, or putting on muscle, and your training was just the opposite side of that. So I think that's why that made that work, because otherwise I would say, you know, you should have been, I mean, as a trainer, I would have said you need to be in your weight training regimen, you need to be doing a combination of strength and power or endurance and power, you know, one of those things. But I could see how you offset that just by the way you were conditioning, you know, because of your sport. I think it's really interesting. So let me ask you this then. Did you do a lot of, like before the match, did you, obviously you studied the person that you were going to be fighting. So how much strategy went into that? Like when you were developing, did you like pay attention to the, like what your opponent, his strong points were versus his weak points? And did you plan your fighting strategy for that fight based around that?
Yes, the end systems, because I would study their body and how that moved, because that would tell me how efficient their techniques were in the energy scale.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can only, it's 25 minute match. So
right. Yeah.
The human body can only do so much
right.
over that term.
Yeah.
And so I would study their body structure and how they used energy, what was efficient and what wasn't. So that was like the biomechanical study.
Yeah.
And then I would study their martial arts training. So say if he was a wrestler or a boxer or this and that, I would study that system to find out the areas that are both strong and then the areas that are weak.
Yeah.
So if it was a wrestler, I knew the minute I turned him to his back, psychologically, he would fatigue out.
Yeah.
And then they wouldn't know what to do. If it was a boxer, I knew that if I kicked the leg or if I stepped away from power and like pressed them on the cage, that they would overwork their systems, because that's not the game of boxing.
Yeah.
And so I would pick apart the body, pick apart the system itself, and then I would watch all their fights and look for all the tells, look for the things that they do in repetition, the things that are part of their system, their reaction, you know, their process. And then I would kind of combine those three things together and come up with a strategy.
Yeah. So then, and how, then again, there's the reality of being in the fight itself. And of course you're going in prepared. And you're a student of the game. Yeah, I talk about in with bodybuilding, we wrote these training courses, and then we call them serious growth. And basically the mindset of I call it a serious growther, is that person who is a student of the game. You obviously were a student of the game, you know, and there's things we have a creed. I call it a creed that we talk about, you know, we question everything. We're a student of the game. Repetition is a mother's skill. You know, there's just different things that to be a student of the game and to master this thing, you have to fill in all the gaps, because otherwise, and it's just like in baseball, for example, if you can't hit a curveball, at some point you will be exposed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right? The higher you go, you can get away with it for a while, you know. So I would imagine that when you were studying your opponents, did you ever come across an opponent where it's like, hey, this guy's pretty well matched with me? I can tell that he's a student of the game. I'm a student of the game. So then I assume that in the ring, that you got to be also very smart about how to win that fight when you're dealing with somebody like that, right?
Yeah. And then it came down to psychology.
Psychology. Yeah.
So that's where, you know, there's the mechanics and then there's the psychology. And that's where I would beat most people. Because they'd be so focused on the mechanics, I'd be out picking on them or spreading misinformation or even talking to people during a fight, because it's incredibly distracting to have someone, you know, be feeding information to your brain when your brain is listening to your corner and sort of relying on that information.
Jedi tactics.
I would do all of these psychological warfare to people.
Yeah.
But because I'd studied so much and I figured it out, you know, I'd identify a few weaknesses. But then, the biggest struggle for all of us is we're running into this fight and there's all this stress and tension and things to deal with that we have to process. And so if you can add more to that and help confuse or distract or even help the machine second guess itself, that's where I excelled. I'd pick on people.
Yeah. Interesting. I like that.
Yeah.
A lot of ways to win a fight, right? A lot of ways to win a game. I mean, totally. Muhammad Ali was one of the masters inside the ring with people, wasn't he?
Yeah. Because he would get you thinking about things and considering things that really had nothing to do with the moment. In fact, that's what Arnold Schwarzenegger used to do in bodybuilding.
He'd
come over, your quads are small, and people would freak out and be like, I gotta focus on my quads.
It wasn't
about the quads. It was about just to distract the game and to keep, you know, keep the competition going.
Yeah, he was really good at that. In fact, there was, I don't know if you ever saw the, I think it was called either Pumping Iron or Stay Hungry. It's one of those.
Yeah.
But I remember he was sitting at the table with Louis Ferrigno's. I think it was Louis's first time at the Olympia. Did you see that by chance?
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember. Yeah, you know, he looked over at Louis and goes, can you imagine how I feel? This is right before the Olympia. He goes, I called my mom today, and the show was the next day. He goes, I called my mom, and he said, I told her I won the Olympia for the sixth time, Louis. Can you imagine how I feel? You know, he was just he was army that way. You know, Louis was. And Arnold was. And he was cantankerous that way, but exactly doing what you're talking about. Just took them out of their game, you know, distraction. Yeah,
you have to do it because that's the last edge. You know, everyone builds up a certain level of psyche to perform. But if you can slowly crack away that. In fact, my favorite one was that when I fought Tito Ortiz, you know, he was 230, cutting down to 199.99.
Yeah.
And I made it with weights in my pockets because I didn't want him to know that I was like 190 pounds.
Yeah,
so I put in a bunch of stuff in my book. I had all kinds of stuff in my pocket, so I'd weigh 197.
Yeah.
But I made weight. It took him three tries, and he had an hour to do it.
Yeah.
And he was a couple pounds off. So while he's sitting in the sauna,
right,
I'm eating a chicken salad in front of the sauna, and
there
like
you just
checking in on him. You know, like, hey, buddy, how's that? And he's in there dying, like killing himself.
Yeah.
And I'm out talking to everybody and eating a chicken salad and like having a blast.
Yeah.
But I just know like what that did to his brain.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, he's thinking, wow, he's out there resting. He's enjoying this. And I'm in here suffering.
You're wicked, Frank. You're wicked, dude. Hey. Yeah. oh, God, that's too funny. Hey, I'm going to ask you a question. Were you ever really hurt in a match? You know, kind of like that you. So let me ask you this. Were you really ever really hurt? And how much was Will a part of you succeeding?
I mean, towards the end of my career, I started getting hurt, like break things and go to the hospital even after I won or even you know, in the process of winning.
Yeah.
So, you know, it really tested my psychological resolve because, you know, when I fought Kong Lee, he broke my arm. Like I blocked it bad. He broke my arm. And when I was hitting, I could tell that, you know, when the bones line up, they vibrate all the way down to your foot.
Yeah.
But my bones were broken. So it would stop here and vibrate. And it was just so painful and psychologically distracting. So my brain knows your arm is broken. But the will to fight and my belief in the strategy carried on.
Amazing.
So it was my last few fights where I really had to overcome, you know, these psychological burdens. And the fight before that, I had torn out my MCL, ACL, PCL, my left knee. And so I could barely walk, you know, 2 weeks before the match. So for me, it was like, well, I still believe I could beat the guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, the psychology of having to change my style, not being able to squat down, not being able to put weight on it, it really distracted me. And I was able to win that fight.
Yeah.
But the broken arm one, like I eventually lost because once he kicked it and the bones moved over, you know, the pain was too great. I couldn't.
I mean, obviously you need your hands. I mean, it's pretty hard to hide that weakness.
Yeah.
You know,
I still think I could have beat him. Yeah. It was literally like the pain was so bad. My brain was like, you're going to crap yourself any moment.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
I was like, well, I think
you know, what's really amazing to me because, you know, I learned this I had some health issues 8 years ago. I had these three strokes that paralyzed me and three strokes in 3 weeks. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, you talk about digging down and having will, you know, so I can relate to you a little bit on that side of it. But it's amazing to me how powerful the mindset can be, you know, and thought is the most powerful thing in the world. And yet we have a hard time harnessing that as human nature until you get in situations like what you're talking about. And then you find out just what you can do. You know, when you really have that will and that drive and that motivation. I mean, obviously you had to have that and that love and passion to be able to withstand that, even to any degree, I would think.
Yeah. And I mean, everything I've seen is it really exists in everybody.
Yeah,
and
it does.
It just needs to be developed and leaned into. And
yeah.
Everybody's got that thing.
Yeah.
That's how we got to this point in society.
That's a good point. You know,
everyone's got it, but you know, most people don't focus on it, or they don't build it, and they, you know, they're worried about it instead of stepping forward and leaning into it.
Yeah. And then, and then on top of that, it takes a hell of a lot of discipline and a long time of discipline, you know, and that's like in our sport, so many people have come to me over the years, because I still have a training studio and I've trained a lot of people. And I said, you know, I'm going to tell you right now, because I actually try to run people off a little bit, because I know what's going to happen in the end. I said, you probably like the idea of actually being up on stage compared to the reality of what you're going to have to do to get on stage. It's going to be hours and hours, like you. It's hours and hours of study and training. And if people have no concept, not really, you know, and then until you start talking to them, or actually them being on the stage, it's like, oh, yeah, now I understand why it takes so many years to be at that level that you were, you know, and it sounds nice. It's like, yeah, you wish that you could be up there, but you're probably not based on stats. Okay. So now I want to ask you about the, you're a visionary and an entrepreneur. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what that means?
Well, that means for me, I mean, the visionary thing really came from the sport itself, because I was, unbeknownst to me, because I wasn't a martial artist and I didn't come up through sports, I didn't know that you weren't supposed to ask questions and write everything down and study the body. And, you know, I was unaware that these, you know, ideas were in place inside of my own sport. And so in the beginning, I was the nerd with the notebook and people would laugh at me.
Yeah.
But after a very short period of time, I was the visionary, because I was creating things that no one had ever thought of.
Yeah.
And because I was asking questions and I was teaching and I was studying theory and, you know, I was creating the sport on notebooks, and that just hadn't been thought of at the time.
Yeah.
But I applied that same process to business. I applied the same process to filmmaking. Now I'm a filmmaker and I do asset management and product development, because to me it's the same process. Like, if you can envision something of value or something of worth or something that people might need, you can create it.
Yeah.
And most people just give up, like, oh, I got a great idea, and then that's it.
Right.
You know, it's challenging, like you said, getting on stage, going through the process of, you know, developing and creating and bringing it all the way to market, having a good message, having a good, you know, sales process.
Yeah.
And so that's where the visionary comes for me in this world, is I use that same, you know, I'm like a child in school on everything.
Yeah.
I'm constantly learning about things, and I see how they apply to the world. When most people are, well, that's never going to happen. And how am I going to get my widget over here to help these people, even though I believe in it?
Right.
I'm able to see that process.
Yeah.
And to me, it's the pure mechanics, just like the fighting.
Yeah.
And I'm able to apply that to, gosh, I mean, pretty much anything. We've brought films, products, you know, people, you know, TV ideas. You know, I tease when I speak. But, you know, I'm best known for convincing America that cage fighting was a good idea. But it's true. Like, that was my passion, because that was my belief. Like, this is going to be so helpful to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you, like, 20 years later, I'm like, I'm not sure it was.
Yeah.
But, you know, my truth was so powerful that, you know, it took it to network television. You know, it's a multi-billion dollar sport.
Yeah, I would say you're mostly right.
Yeah, when I started, the people were like, "Oh, you know, that's the worst thing I've ever seen." I used to, as a spokesman, my job was to get us back on cable.
Yeah,
I was the first talent spokesman. I'd go talk to the guys in my suit, and they'd laugh at me. They'd be like, "This sport will never be on television. Like, what are you, like, crazy?"
Yeah.
Now we are. You know, here we are, years and years later.
You know, one of the things I've learned over the years is that the masses are usually wrong, and that's proven in history. Yeah. You know, but you just have to have the will and the guts to keep moving forward, because there's so many people, those obstacles are constantly, like what you're saying, that'll never happen. What, are you out of your mind, Frank? You're sick in the head. I think you've been kicked too many times in the head or something. I'm sure you heard that too before.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty funny. So when you're doing your speaking out there, first of all, let me ask you this. Have you developed a system of sorts, but have you developed a system for fighters now that are upcoming that they can refer to a training course or an idea or a strategy?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, I developed the fighting system, Shamrock MMA, which was my 15-year study.
Okay.
And I mean, it's 15 years of studying the body and mechanics and applying it at the highest level.
Yeah.
So I thoroughly stand behind the system as a, you know, martial art, and then as a professional martial arts application. And so that's what we train people in.
Okay.
Is that exact system.
So are you basically, how are you passing that forward as far as the information? Do you are you a trainer for upcoming athletes, or do you oversee that? How does that work out now?
I do nothing for upcoming athletes unless you are a teenage youth in an after-school program or you're in a disadvantaged community. I took that asset and we gave it to the charity. And so right now we're working with like Arnold Schwarzenegger's After School All-Stars to implement that program into the after-school programs.
Yeah.
So kids at risk in that, you know, 3 to 6 time period have something to focus on. If they want to take it to the next level, that's entirely up to them. You know, I got tired of walking on martial arts mats, having my back hurt, and cleaning up, you know, sweaty floors.
Yeah.
So what I did when I retired is I just made a complete exit from it.
Yeah.
And then I gave that to my charity to monetize. So that's my participation in martial arts at this stage. And then what I do for the combative sports side is I help the companies that are trying to get into the space, get on television, you know, create big stars and monetize those stars and bring their leagues to the next level.
Yeah. It almost sounds like what you've done with the kids at risk, which I applaud you, is that you're giving back, you know, to your sport, you know, and that's what you're paying it for, is actually going back and for those kids. I really think that's a great thing that you're doing there. You know, that's pretty cool. Cause I asked myself, you know, after I came back when I was 54 and I did that, Frank, you know, I really, at that point I said, you know, I've really had, kind of like what you're saying, I don't want to do this anymore. I just don't. I really don't. I don't want to put any posing trunks on. I don't want to be on camera, you know, hitting a double bicep anymore. I don't want to do that, you know, but I still wanted to be relative in the industry. So I just asked a different set of questions. And I said, what can I do to, you know, to pay it forward in this case? And I thought, I'll just come back out here and start talking on podcasting, you know, because what I'm seeing in our industry is that, and again, I think social media is a great thing, but it also brings out the loonies in our industry. You know, some of these that you can tell in 3 minutes, kind of like you can size somebody up pretty quickly. And when I am talking to somebody, or if I, you know, some of these social media stars, I call them, I can tell them pretty quickly that, you know, they really don't know what the hell they're talking about. And it's one of those kinds of things that, at least in my sport, it can be a danger to people. They're unsuspecting clients, you know, and you could actually hurt them. So I thought, well, I'll just come back out and try talking to people that are legit in the industry, like you. You know, you may be in martial arts, but again, I have this saying that everything is the same but different, you know, and what you've done crosses over into stuff that I'm doing in the way we approach stuff. You know, you have passion, I have passion for what I do. And I've done things that nobody thought that I could do as well. But it's all based around passion and enthusiasm and staying hungry, kind of like what Arnold talked about in one of those, you know, the films that he did. I think that's pretty common between what you and I have, you know. I think that's something that's common for most people that end up being successful like that, whether you're doing it in film or whatever. So let me ask you this then: with your film now, are you a producer? Are you acting in a film, or what are you doing for films?
I am the executive producer.
Oh, okay.
So I find great ideas. I help nurture them. I connect all the people. To me, it's the same as a championship fight.
There you go.
I find a talented, you know, I find a need. I find talented people. I put them all together, and then I cheer them on until we get to the end of it. Our latest movie was called The Bipolar Rock and Roller.
Okay.
And, you can find it at bipolarmovie.org.
Okay.
It's about one of my clients, one of my close friends, Mauro Ranallo, who's a sports broadcaster.
Okay.
Also has bipolar disorder.
Wow.
And so he lived this crazy life where he's super, super talented, but he also needs like a little bit of care, social care, medication care, physical care. And that stuff is a challenge for him.
Yeah.
So he's been at the heights of, you know, careers. He's lost them. He's, you know, but he's such a talent.
Yeah.
And we did this docu-feature about him, which has really become the sort of educational tool for bipolar disorder. And
nice.
We've thousands, I mean, probably 10,000 emails from people who see the film and they're like, that's my Uncle Jack. Like, yeah. That's my daughter. That's my sister. That's me. And they have this life-changing moment, because one of the things we were able to do in the film was put in these care modules that are so important. Yeah. We partnered with national charities that do this all the time. And we got the right information so that when you watch the film, yeah, it's a great story about a guy who's, you know, living at the height of his talents and abilities and doing amazing, extraordinary things.
Yeah.
But the sub message is, this is totally normal. It's totally okay.
Yeah.
This is how you care for it.
Yeah.
Just been, you know, it's been, I mean, we couldn't have prayed for more impact. Like, it's been so powerful to people and so valuable to people and
changing
lives. So that's where I like to try to be of use, you know, with my skill set, which is putting together these things that people think are crazy. At the beginning, they were like, nobody's going to buy a film about mental health.
Right.
Like, nobody cares. There's no interest. There's no financing. There's no support.
Yeah.
But through the passion of wanting to help people and help my friend. And then after connecting with the mental health communities, everyone's like, okay, no one's going to do it, but we really, really need it.
Yeah.
And so we just found a way to fill the need.
What a way. That's cool, Frank. That's really cool. That's being creative. So excellent question. Unfortunately, we have to get going here, but where do we go? Where do you go from here now? And would you like to promote anything on our podcast, but where do you go from here?
Well, normally I'm on stage about once a week, you know, speaking to corporations, schools. I'm in a leadership kind of motivational capacity, but all of those have been canceled for the virus pandemic. So now I'm just kind of working at home. But we have more corporations lined up this year. We have charity trips that go and build homes. There's a lot of social activism that I do. If you want to find me, I'm at frankshamrock.com all the time. I am at Frank Shamrock on every social media profile. I go where the need is. God sends me where I am needed, and then I show up. If I got to kick someone's ass, I do that. If not, then I just use my big brain to line things up.
You have to adapt on the fly, man, and you're doing really good at that. Anyway, listen, I really do appreciate you coming on. I could keep going on with you. I mean, you're a very fascinating guy, and maybe if you're interested, maybe we can collaborate or do this again, because I'd like to tap into you some more. I like your energy, and I just like the way you think, and I'd like to be, to talk maybe someday again with you about what you're doing.
I'd love that. Yeah, you know? Let's make it happen.
All right. I appreciate your time, Frank, and hey, stay away from that damn coronavirus, okay?
Well, if I get my hands on that virus, it's done.
Kick its ass. Do something with it, okay? All right, man. You take care.
Okay. All right, thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Serious Growth Podcast. For more episodes like the one you just listened to, subscribe to us on your mobile podcast app and leave us a review. If you'd like to reach out, you can find us online at seriousgrowth.com. Until next time, train smart and train hard.